So about a month ago, we started this series on the Buddhist teachings to lay people. And in my introduction on that night, I sort of avoided, I was very intentional in saying that I was avoiding the topic of the teachings on women. And a member of this Sangha, a woman, came up to me afterwards and says, you know, I would actually really like to see you take that on, particularly to see a man take that on. And I thought about it for a few days and decided that I would give it a shot. And it has been quite a challenge. It raises a number of ancillary issues. And so we may not get to all of that tonight, but what I wanted to do was just start and see where it goes. And I'd really like to hear back from you, so I will try to leave some time for that. I apologize that I didn't get my blurb to the e-news in time to forewarn you about what kind of the territory. So let me just read you what I sent. We'll explore the challenges of differing cultural contexts, winnowing what the Buddha said from suttas that were written down long after he spoke them, and recent developments for women in Buddhism. We will use suttas from Bhikkhu Bodhi's book In the Buddha's Words, which we used last time, and as well as selections from The Hidden Lamp, edited by Florence Kaplow and Susan Moon. Be prepared for an evening of discussion and challenging what we think we know and maybe even who we think we are. So with that introduction, I want to start by just saying that I hope that nothing I say tonight will be taken as a negative on Indian culture. You know, we're talking about a culture from 2,500 years ago. And I also want to hope that nothing I say tonight implies that we've got it all figured out in this culture. Okay? I was on Fair Oaks Boulevard on Tuesday. I was following a pickup truck. And on the window was a sticker that said, "Wife and dog missing, reward for dog." There was another sticker on the same truck that said WWBD. And I thought, that better not be what would the Buddha do. It wasn't. It was what would Bubba do. So I felt a little relieved that this was not a Buddhist message that was being spread. Wife and dog missing, reward for dog. So, you know, let's be really careful about being self-righteous that our society has this whole thing figured out and that women are treated equally in this society. It just isn't true. And you take on a topic like this and then you start seeing it everywhere. And I got my California magazine from my university. I had a whole page of the inequalities at UC Berkeley. And, you know, this so-called liberal institution. On and on, I could give you a million of them, but... 20% of the faculty are women. 53% of the students are. 20% of the faculty are. None of their 22 Nobel laureates are women. 60% of the Nobel committee is women, and 5% of the laureates. It just goes on and on. So 30% of the doctors and 95% of the nurses are women. It just goes on and on. And you all heard the stuff today about the Academy Awards, right?
Oh, yeah.
So I don't even need to go into that. It's just, they're not equal in our society. In the area of religion, I find it interesting that, if we're going to criticize this 2,500-year-old culture, it's interesting that in our country, the first woman minister to be ordained was Olympia Brown. She was a Universalist minister. She was ordained in 1863. So the Christian church didn't allow women to be religious leaders until 1863. And I could tell you about her struggle, but it was a struggle to get there. The other issue that we have to acknowledge before taking on a topic like this is, how do we approach the suttas? How are these teachings supportive of our practice? And yet, how are we true to these teachings? So I purposely, when I wrote up the title for this talk, I purposely called it Buddhist Teachings on Women, not the Buddha's Teachings on Women. Because the suttas, as you know, were written down long after the Buddha lived. There was a long period when they were orally transmitted, and then they were finally written down, and who knows what happened in that interim. And then some of the suttas were written down before others, and so any amount of cultural overlay could have happened in that period that affected the content. There could have been political agendas or religious agendas that affected how they were written down. So we really need to be aware of that, but we also need to bear in mind that perhaps taking the suttas and just arbitrarily throwing out things that we don't like is not a skillful approach to studying. That we really need some guidance in how we approach these things. And there is current scholarship going on, just as there was in the Christian religions with the Bible, where there were scholars that had ways of kind of triangulating the texts and coming out with what Jesus is most likely to have said versus what was just completely made up. And there are editions now that are available that have what he probably said, you know, in one color text and everything else in another color text. And you find out it's not that much. So, you know, this process is just starting in sutta scholarship. As you probably know, when these things were first written down, they were written down by, when they're first translated, they were translated by people who were trying to emulate King James Bible, you know, that version of English. Mm-hmm. And so by that very structure of the language, certain concepts come across that maybe weren't intended by people in India 2,500 years ago. There also has been scholarship in terms of what's sometimes called sutta archaeology, you know, just these layers and layers and layers of writings over hundreds of years, and which ones really were the early teachings and which ones came later. One of Tony Bernhardt's rules, which, you know, isn't universal, but I've found it helpful, is that often if there's a list with the numbers, it's probably not original. Probably formulate, it doesn't mean that the Buddha didn't say all those things, but a lot of these were formulaically arranged to be easy to memorize. If you're orally transmitting something, you have to make it easy to memorize, right? So a lot of the later ones were probably compiled maybe from several and then put into these lists that were easy to remember. And another one of Tony's rules is that if it's in verse, there's a very high likelihood that it probably was. Something similar to that was said by the Buddha, or the little quotes within the verses. So, for what that's worth, wanted to put that out there. And finally, one note on the two truths, the relative and the absolute. So, at any time in this practice and in the scholarship and study, and just in our interactions, we're operating at two levels, the relative and the absolute. And in my opinion, and please correct me later on when we get to the discussion if you think this is off base, but in my opinion, things like the role of women are in the realm of the relative. That, I mean, that's why we call this whole series Teachings to Lay People, is that the teachings that the Buddha gave to the lay people were about living their everyday lives and relationships and all of that, and were somewhat different than the teachings on liberation, which he primarily delivered to monks, to full liberation. So when we're, John Travis, when he was instructing the mentors just before we began to teach, told us that the easiest way to get into trouble when you're in this seat is to answer a relative question as if it was absolute, or an absolute question as if it was relative. You know, because those realms have different language and different, I mean, some of you have experienced, you know, touches of the absolute in meditation, and you know when you come out of there to try to explain it in words is very difficult. So just a note on that, that I'm not saying that anything I'm going to say today is going to get you to full liberation. That's not what this is about. Okay? Enough caveats? Any questions on any of that preamble? All right. I first found it interesting to note that almost all of the Buddha's teachings on women, at least in here, weren't actually about women. They were about wives. If you look at the suttas in here, they're almost all about wives, about relationships. So you may recall that we have been talking about the Sigalavada Sutta, which is the worshipping in the six directions, when the Buddha takes this young man and says, well, that Vedic way that you're worshipping in the six directions isn't right. Really, the six directions are, and then he lays out this series of relationships, right? Relationships between husbands and wives, parents and children, teachers and students, and so forth. So the instructions I think I have here. In that sutta, to husbands and wives, are that husbands should be honoring, they should honor the wives, they should not be disparaging. Let's see, my grammar is messed up here. The qualities that husbands should have in regard to their wives is they should be honoring them, should be not disparaging them, they should not being unfaithful to them, they should be giving them authority, and they should be providing them with adornments. Okay. With regard to husbands, wives should be properly organizing their work, being kind to servants, not being unfaithful, protecting the stores, you know, the things of the household, and being skillful and diligent in all they have to do. You know, some of those things certainly seem worth paying attention to. Some seem very culturally distant. And if we're going to take this bringing it into our modern world to extremes, what I thought I should do is reframe this so that it would apply to any couple, male, female, male, male, female, female, or other. So just picture any partner in a relationship honoring, not disparaging, not being unfaithful, giving authority, providing with adornments. It's kind of funny, right? It doesn't really make sense in a way. How about in the other direction, properly organizing work, being kind to servants, not being unfaithful, protecting stores, being skillful and diligent in all they have to do. So when you reframe it that way, you can really see the inequality, right, of the back and forth. So there may or may not be something useful in there. Another sutta is the four kinds of marriage, and often the Buddha, well, there I go again. Often the suttas are set up so that they'll take two extremes and they'll put them in all four combinations, like with like and unlike with unlike, you know. So they'll take two poles and then they'll say the four kinds of this, that, and the other thing, okay, just by taking those two. So in this case, the four kinds of marriage are the marriage of a wretch with a wretch. I hope none of those are laughs of recognition. The marriage of a wretch with a god, the marriage of a goddess with a wretch, and the marriage of a god with a goddess. Okay, this is the language that he's using. So I'm not going to go into the qualities of the wretch on either side. But the qualities of the goddess are that she follows the precepts, that she's virtuous, of good character, dwells with a heart free from the stain of stinginess, and does not abuse or revile ascetics and Brahmins. And then the same for the god. Okay? So you listen to that, and there's Dana, right? Heart free from the stain of stinginess, that's Adina Dana, right? It's the training that we undertake. Is to refrain from having a heart with the stain of stinginess. Follows the precepts, that's sila, following the precepts. And that's how we do it, right? To the extent we do it. And what's missing? Meditation practice, right? Dana, sila, bhavana, of those three trainings. So, you know, as we talked about before, the instructions to lay people, as Diane made really clear last week, the instruction to lay people often omit meditation training and often concentrate on these qualities. But these are not bad qualities to recommend to someone for daily life, right? And he recommends the same thing. He describes the same qualities present in a god and a goddess, completely equal. Okay? So even though this is four kinds of marriage, they could be turned around to apply to any two people that are together. Leading with the precepts. There was another one where a couple comes to him and they ask how to be united in future lives. So there's kind of an overlay there about future lives, and Bhikkhu Bodhi insists that we can't throw any of that stuff out. I'll just put a word in for him since we're using his book. I don't find it particularly helpful, but you know, I don't reject it out of hand. But anyway, these folks came to the Buddha and they said, you know, we're really happy in this life, how can we be united in future lives? And he said, faith, moral discipline, which is just sila again, just different translation, generosity, wisdom. Faith, moral discipline, generosity, and wisdom. So there, you actually have the three trainings of the Noble Eightfold Path in his instructions to the lay people. You have sila, moral discipline, generosity, dana, and wisdom, panya, right there. So it's very interesting that in this case, when he's talking about actually making it into future lives, which would be, you know, good karma, right? In this system, build up your good karma and you'll make it into a future life and they'll stay united. I think in this, I'm not going to go try to look it up, I think in this particular one he said they would be in Tusita heaven or one of the Deva realms. Okay. And this one is all given in verse, the particular sutta. All these are given in verse. Actually, I will read it to you, just to give you a taste of what these verses sound like. They're quite different than the formulaic repetitions that we often see in the suttas. When both are faithful and generous, self-restrained of righteous living, they come together as husband and wife, full of life for each other. Many blessings come their way. They dwell together in happiness. their enemies are left dejected when both are equal in virtue. Having lived by Dhamma in this world, the same in virtue and observance, they rejoice after death in the Deva world, enjoying abundant happiness. That's kind of how the verses sound. So, the four kinds of marriage leads with following the precepts. How to be united in future lives leads with faith, just like the five spiritual faculties, right? Faith is the first one. The second one is sila, moral discipline. So I want to make it really clear that we have been speaking in this daily life series about some of the differences between the way we talk about daily life versus how some of the secular mindfulness teaching that's going around now approaches how mindfulness should be applied to daily life. And really the big omission in our view, I mean, I'm just speaking for Madhyan and me right now, is the omission of sila, of following the precept of moral conduct. The idea is you can just keep doing what you're doing as long as you're mindful, you know, that's good enough. I hear that sometimes in secular mindfulness teachings. Not the ones that are really grounded in this tradition, you know, like mindfulness-based stress reduction. Jon Kabat-Zinn is really grounded in this tradition. Mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, the folks that did that work are very grounded in this tradition. But some of the twice and three times removed from this tradition, you will often get the teaching of mindfulness without the moral discipline that I think we all recognize is a pretty essential part of the practice in daily life. So it was interesting to see that coming up. Okay, here's one of the tough ones. So there was this young woman who was going to be married to, let's just say, a prince. I mean, you know, like the Buddha, it wasn't really a prince and a king. It was a very different system. It was these sort of tribal things. And so whoever was the head of the tribe or the clan in the King James version would come out being a king and his son would be a prince. So, anyway, this young woman was going to be married to him, and she was sort of like the woman in the Taming of the Shrew. You know? She was out of hand, in their view. Okay. So they came to the Buddha, and they asked him, well, how can we, you know, straighten this woman out? And he said, you know, just have her come talk to me. And so she came in, and interestingly enough, she's this wild woman, and she comes in and she gives her respects and she sits down to one side. You know, just like the most respectful monks that you've ever heard in the suttas, always they come, they pay respects and they sit down to one side. So I thought, well, that was a good start. You know. And he says to her, there are seven kinds of wives. And I'll just list them here. I'm not going to give you all the characteristics, but first one's the slayer. Second one's the thief. The third one is the tyrant. The fourth one is the mother. Fifth one is the sister. Sixth one is the friend. And the seventh one, Bhikkhu Bodhi translates as handmaid, and he has a footnote. Now, I don't know how many of you saw the article on translation in the Buddha Dharma magazine, in the last one. The translators took on this issue of cherry-picking the suttas. They were having this conversation with Buddha Dharma magazine. And they said, well, what do you... Like they asked the Tibetan translator, they asked her, you know, what do you do about this huge cultural divide from these sutras that were written down so long ago? And she says, oh, she says, I use a lot of footnotes. You know? So this footnote, and then to finish the story, so he goes through these seven kinds and he says, now which one are you going to be? And she says, I'll be the handmaid. Bhikkhu Bodhi's footnote says, Dasi, literally, a female slave. Fortunately, this is Bhikkhu Bodhi's footnote, fortunately, in Buddhist societies, this recommendation has not been taken very seriously. And the first three models of the ideal wife, mother, sister, and friend, have prevailed. So here's Bhikkhu Bodhi. He's telling us that we have to buy everything about karma. We have to buy multiple lives. You know, we have to buy that dependent origination is in a past life and this life and the next life. All of a sudden saying, but the Buddha's recommendation to this young woman that she be a female slave to her husband is way off base, and thank goodness that Buddhist societies haven't taken it on. Okay? So if you ever read a sutta and you feel uncomfortable with it because it has a culturally inappropriate approach to women, you're in good company. Mm-hmm. Bhikkhu Bodhi knows his stuff. The quality, he has the set of qualities for each of these seven types, and they start overlapping. They start, if you go to the list that I gave you earlier, there'll be two from this list and three from that list. So you can sort of see this process of these lists being reworked, you know, so that people can remember them. But they're basically the same characteristics. So there is this discourse to Visakha, and Diane talked last time about Anathapindika, who was the Buddha's premier lay male disciple. Visakha is his premier lay female disciple. So she also built a monastery, which, you know, they're not really monasteries, right? And at that time, they were just places to hang out. In the eastern part of Savatthi. So she came to him at one point and asked him about the qualities needed for success in this world and the other world. And he basically gave her 10 of the qualities that we've just listed. But I found this passage really interesting in how he described wisdom to her. Because you remember the question that Diane started with last week is, can lay people be liberated in this lifetime? So this is how he described, this is what he said to Visakha. How is a woman accomplished in wisdom? Now he's noticing here this is one of the exceptions. So he's actually talking about women. He's not talking about wives. How is a woman accomplished in wisdom? Here, Visakha, a woman possesses the wisdom that sees into the arising and passing away of phenomena, that is noble and penetrative and leads to the complete destruction of suffering. Now, seeing into the arising and passing away of phenomena is a pretty high bar, right? And that's right in the Satipatthana Sutta, is what you need to do when you're meditating. Noble, we know from the Noble Eightfold Path, just means that it's conduct that is ennobling, that makes us, purifies us. Penetrative is a term that's used in terms of concentration, that it gets down below the surface and it penetrates to the truth of the way things are. That's what that term means in this context. And leading to the complete destruction of suffering, that sounds pretty clear that yes, women can be liberated. There is a famous story. It's not about our tradition, but it has to be brought up in this context. And it's about Sung San. He's a Korean Zen master. And it pertains to this instruction to Visakha. And I'm just going to read it. You go on the internet, there's multiple versions of this, including in his own book. So I'm just going to read this. The title of it is Women Cannot Get Enlightenment. One day, one of Master Sung San's female American students asked him, "Sir, are there any women Zen masters in Korea?" "No, no, no," he quickly replied. "Of course not." The student was completely shocked, even angered by this, more so because Zen Master Sung San himself had always treated his female students with complete equality and even formally authorized several of them to teach. How could he think like this, she thought. This is completely outrageous. After a few moments, she stammered out, "But how is this possible?" Eyeing her and half smiling, he replied, "Because women cannot get enlightenment." This was unbelievable. Half expecting that he was joking, she looked up, but by then he had already marched into another room. She followed him, where he had busied himself with some things, almost as if the conversation had never occurred. "I have been practicing with you for several years now," she continued. "You have always just taught us to believe in our true self 100%. How can you possibly now say that women cannot get enlightenment?" Wheeling around sharply, Zen Master Sung Song pointed his finger at her and, looking into her eyes strongly, said, "So, you're a woman?" The student was silent as his teaching sank in. So that's about clinging to any identity, right? That's one of the last ones to go, identity view. So just a caution in all of this, that this is a lesson for all of us. We're clinging to some kind of identity. Now, whether that's your identity as a woman, my identity as a man, whatever it might be, just be aware that that's in the realm of the relative. You know, that at the realm of the absolute, all that goes away. Now, having said that, you know, we live in this world and our practice calls us to work for justice and to treat people fairly and all of that. But I wanted to finish with that before our discussion as a reminder that so you're a human being, you know, you're a woman, you're a man, so what, you know, that's not, that identity view is not going to get you to liberation. Comments, questions, complaints? Yes, Fred.
Well, first of all,
Fred and I have been discussing this topic for a month, so I knew this was coming.
Yeah, I made a special effort to be here tonight. Thank you, Richard, for you know, very interesting presentation. As I hear it and understand it, you were able to take that comment. The anecdote, you know, and find a lot, you know, a transcendent passage through all the words that you quoted, and some of them are, you know, very livable. The first one, I'm trying to recollect what it was. It was, I think, the five things that a husband and wife should do.
Yeah,
you know,
that's right.
Was pretty misogynistic. And it's hard to work around that. And I guess the problem is, and we briefly kind of talked about, you know, is how do you deal with trying to really honor and preserve the heritage of a way of thought, of Buddhism, specifically now, at the same time, you know, move it forward, you know, to maybe something better. Now, that may be presumptuous of me to say, but a lot of the words that you quoted are, you really have to work hard to get around them, and if one were to take them at the relative level, it leaves us pretty stuck.
Right.
You know, and I guess there's a prevailing question behind the whole thing is you know, how do you keep the heritage and honor it, but at the same time not be chained by it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, because there's a lot of words there. And, you know, I've come out of the Christian faith, and, you know, there's always this comment, you know, the devil can quote from the Bible, which indeed they could, you know, I mean, there's some horrible things in there. And I suspect that I haven't delved in, as you have, into the Buddhist literature, but there's probably some dark things there, too. How do we deal with that? You know, you did a great job of finding a way out, but the words are still there.
Yeah, they are. Well, I think each of us in our study needs to find what supports our practice. You know, in this tradition, we're not studying just for the sake of studying. You know, I see study as a support for practice. And I think it is useful as your practice matures to actually take some of this stuff on firsthand, rather than take my word for it or anybody else's word for it, but to actually take some of this on. So having said that, at the risk of really sounding dismissive, I would not go to the suttas for marriage counseling. I wouldn't. I mean, I'm not a Buddhist in the sense that I buy into everything that the Buddha or anybody around him ever said as the way to live my life. I mean, I have other ethical trainings that I find useful. I go to this for advice on meditation and ethical conduct. I don't go to it for...
That's the absolute.
Yeah, right. Whatever hint I can get toward the absolute from a bunch of words on a piece of paper. But I don't rely on this for this kind of advice. You know, it's interesting that it's there. We need to be aware of it because, you know, as I mentioned before, we can get into that a little bit more, it's having repercussions today, yesterday, and tomorrow in terms of women trying to be, for example, fully ordained as nuns in this current situation with Theravada Buddhism. So it's very relevant and we need to take it on. But in terms of how I use the suttas to support my practice, I don't go to it for marriage counseling advice or for advice on how to manage money or any of that. Please.
A little bit of a follow-on to that.
Please.
So as you're studying this material and looking at it, what have you found in there, if anything, that has sort of touched something new or inspired you or been helpful in some way looking at your relationship with Mary or with women or in those areas?
Yeah. Well, I actually find this woman's story to be very inspiring. I mean, as I mentioned when I went through these lists, you know, the fact that he was recommending faith, generosity, ethical conduct, and wisdom, you know, as the qualities. Once he got to a place where he was treating the sexes equally, you know, I found that really inspiring to know that that's a universal message, and I find those things really important as well. But in terms of a woman's story, you know, this is Maha Prajapati, who was the aunt that raised the Buddha after his mother died in childbirth. And she came to the Buddha and herself after many years and wanted to establish basically the bhikkhuni order. She wanted to establish an order of nuns. And he turned her down. And asked a second time, and he turned her down. Asked a third time, he turned her down again. Now, those of you that know the suttas know that usually if you ask three times, you get what you want, right? So she went to Ananda and said, I just asked the Buddha three times if he'd establish a, you know, bhikkhuni order, and he said no. So what do you think about that? And Ananda went to the Buddha and spoke with him, and he consented to establish, to allow nuns. And so she was ordained, and then she brought in a whole bunch of other women with her, and they used to travel around with the monks. So that persistence and that, I mean, in a way, that, I mean, he had up and left the household, right? And so that perseverance and that kind of the fact that she had this sort of long-term view of the relationship and was able to persevere through some really hard times, you know, I find that really inspiring.
Um, some of this stuff is difficult for me to put into words, but one of the things is, when you brought this up when we talked about it earlier, and said I should say something, so I'm going to say something. One of the things that I've noticed is the double-edged nature of this dualistic view of men and women and cultural differences between. And I've been really struck for years, but particularly recently, because I've been reading more Thai forest things and studying more Thai forest stuff, and knowing that it's the Thai forest monks that don't want women to be, don't really think women can be ordained anymore. And having to come to the determination that it's like a lot of things, I mean, the Buddha said, take what works, try it for yourself. And I'm having also to accept that there are people that have these amazingly perceptive viewpoints, amazingly clear, heartfelt, and real, that have places where I don't agree. And I have to accept that both things are true for me, and still take the part that really, really rings right. I also think that in my relative life, looking at our sort of sexual biases and orientations about how we look at things, we each, speaking for myself, I need to examine what part of those things I play into, because there's always two sides to those things. And the consistency to me in sort of misogynistic thinking is basically age old. It seems to transcend many, many cultures. It's been with us for a very long time. So I don't know what that is. It's bigger than I am. But I also know that because I was raised in that culture, I have certain expectations of being treated that way, of that stuff being true in that relative way. So when you told that story, it's again going, the thing that I get from that story is, it doesn't matter what anybody says. It doesn't matter what a man says. It doesn't matter what... If this stuff is true, it's true. And if you do the stuff, you can be enlightened. You don't need permission. You know?
I agree with that. That's an absolute. I find it very interesting because I grew up around strong women. And my grandmother used to say, you know, if you want to know the truth, ask a woman. And to me, that just meant that a woman's truth is the truth. It's not to be challenged or compared to what I think as a man. And so, to me, I think enlightenment is acceptance of what a woman's perception is about who she is and what she is trying to obtain. And I think we fight against that in our society. And so when I listen to this, I'm looking for the absolute truth, and that seems to be the truth, that it is for anyone. It's not just for a man, it's not just for a woman, it's for anyone. Anyone can become enlightened. I think we take on roles in life, but I think sometimes in our society we devalue women's roles, which I think really is the foundation to our civilization. Someone is nurturing and supporting and holding us up. Someone is teaching us about tenderness and love as we develop in this society. And I just find it interesting that wherever we go, there's always this perception that the woman's role is less than. And it's not. And for me, my view has always been it's greater than. It's a greater than. So I agree with what you just said. It's for anybody. It's for anybody.
Well said.
I just want to say how much I appreciate your taking this on. I just feel relief that as a Sangha, we can look at it together. Misogyny creates a lot of suffering. And it's about, you know, looking at what is and not putting it under the rug, because if we don't deal with our shadow, and we're a human tradition, and the Buddha was human, we we don't deal with our shadow, it's going to come up and bite us in the butt some way or other. So I just, it's such a relief. It's a very spacious feeling to have this, for us to be able to look at it together. And I'm especially touched given, you know, everything that's in the news about France, etc., and, mm-hmm. and the forces in Islam who are trying to bring Islam into modernity suffer terrible, terrible consequences. And just the contrast is so ripe right now. So I just appreciate your bringing that up. I could see your hand shaking a little bit. And once it was said, it wasn't as bad as I thought it was going to be.
Thanks, Rich, for the talk. It was, well, for me, I know women can be like good my granny was, so I what it did for me, what the talk did for me is I was feeling the same as like when people talk about racial issues or whatever, it stirs the same, it's like that ignorance part of me that the way I was brought up. You know, mom would have dad a beer and a piece of cheese so he would be happy and, you know, and all this kind of stuff. And when in practice I start challenging those beliefs and they just really don't hold water. And when you're talking, those were the feelings that were going on inside of me, is the same as the racial or the same. It's all these things I learned as a young man. And I thought, I was wondering like what it would be like in a couple of years if the political scene changes and we do have, you know, if the environment would have been a disaster, you know, like it is now or whatever, seeing where that's going to lead. So, anyway, I appreciate you taking this on.
There's a practice in Tibetan stuff that's really interesting to generate compassion. And it's basically to look at anyone like you as my mother. And my mother many times over, and the image is, even if you had a bad mother, she grew you up and gave birth to you and suckled you, at least for a while. And so, you know, the fundamental act of compassion is right there. Mm-hmm. And so I've practiced that, and it's amazing when you do that indiscriminately, the effect that it has on you in terms of deepening. So I mean, it's coming in contact with a female in this really basic way. And another observation is, you have a female right up there, mm-hmm. The Vaitara.
Vaitara, yeah.
Who is the perfection.
So, also thank you. And I think it does take some courage just to be in that seat, whether you were male or had you been female, to understand that you're taking on a topic that people will have such feelings about and that wherever you sit, it has to shape it. So thank you for being willing to do that. And I want to say, listening to particularly the first piece of the sutta, the one that clearly anticipated different roles for men and women, that didn't surprise me. I mean, we are talking about a culture 2,500 years ago, and I assume that given that he was talking in the relative world and talking to people about relationships in that world, that how he delineated desirable qualities for a partner wouldn't be equal. But what actually hit me more powerfully was it did not seem misogynist to me. That if you just looked at the qualities, regardless of that we would now disagree that the qualities should be sliced that way by gender, that actually the qualities on both sides were qualities that were very worthy. Worthy qualities for a person to have and worthy qualities to give a partner. So I was struck that, for instance, when he talked about what a woman should be doing, he didn't say obey. He didn't say prostrate yourself to your husband. He actually said manage the stores wisely, be honest. And so the picture that emerged to me and what he said to the husband was not govern your wife, or things that we would see as insurmountably misogynistic. He actually said be honest, don't disparage adorn, you know, I mean, who hasn't maybe given their partner a nice sweater or a nice necklace if the partner happens to be, you know, someone who would like that. But that each of these things, if taken as simply a quality in a relationship, seemed really worthy, and that both partners, even if you didn't agree with how their roles were divided, had qualities, each of which would be a quality of a person of substance who was contributing to a partnership. So I actually thought there was a lot of wisdom in it, even though there's no way in my life in this century that I would say, oh yeah, these you know, particular ones go in the male column and these are in the female. And I do find those kinds of teachings from the suttas about relationships and about relative life actually quite moving.
Thank you. Full disclosure, the ones about submitting and all that are in there. I just didn't read them. I mean, they're not in that sutta. They're in the one with the seven kinds of wives. So one thing I wanted to mention relative to the bhikkhuni ordination issue that came up is that there is a monk from Australia named Ajahn Brahm, who has been one of the primary monks supporting full bhikkhuni ordination in the Theravada tradition. And he's going to be coming to Sacramento February 19th. So that's our regular night. That's the week before Steve Armstrong. And so they contacted several of us about supporting his visit here. And we decided that since the last talk that he gave, there were 5,000 people there, maybe we shouldn't have it here. So it's going to be over at B'nai Israel, and we'll be partnering with SBMG and American Buddhist Seminary and some other organizations in town to make that happen. He's on a book tour, but this is not his Sacramento visit is not about selling his book. I mean, there may be some, but it's not what it's about. All the dana from that evening is going to go to the Dhammadharini Monastery in Sonoma County, which he's very connected with, and participated in their ordinations over there. So just so you know, that's coming up, and we may want to help them with some set up volunteers and so forth, because we're really expecting a big turnout there. So that could be something concrete where you could actually go listen to somebody that's really in favor of this. And I'm not sure what his topic's going to be, but I'm sure he'll touch on it, either on his own or in response to questions. So Ajahn Brahm, February 19th, B'nai Israel. I think that's enough for tonight. Anything else?
In relation to the question that you brought up, I heard someone doing an interview to the Dalai Lama that brought up the same exact kind of question. How do you deal with teachings that are kind of louder? Okay, sorry. How do you deal with teachings that are obsolete for modern times? How do you deal with any teaching? And his answer was, get rid of them. As simple as that, get rid of them. Teachings for women, teachings for, the Dalit, they don't apply to modern times. They're completely obsolete, so they're not useful. Quite the contrary, they only cause more harm than benefit. So I was quite surprised, actually, for he was very straightforward giving him that answer.
Yes, consistent with what he said at his Science of Mind conference, too. You know, if the findings of science conflict with the findings of Buddhism, we'll go with the findings of science. You know, he's said that pretty, just like you say, pretty straightforward.
I've been pondering this as the session goes on and people have been talking. And it seems like, for any religion or a transcendent philosophy, obviously we're talking about Buddhism tonight, is that it's really important to really focus on the core, the real meat, the real important stuff. And in Buddhism, there's a at a pretty high level, a transcendent, the precepts or whatever, transcendent ethical structure, and then there's the search for enlightenment or truth, however you want to put it. And those are the things that are really, really important, it seems to me. And the rest of the stuff, you know, maybe we should, you know, look at it and stuff, you know, but it really is, you know, not that important, mm-hmm. you know, and it shouldn't interfere with the other stuff.
Right. It's called the heartwood of the Bodhi tree.
Yeah. You said it so much better.
The leaves just fall off, but the heartwood remains.
Yeah,
that's helpful.
Yeah. All right, well, let's take a moment to just recognize that in this world there are so many that suffer, whether it's women that are oppressed or ethnic national identities that are being attacked, and to just know that this practice, if we really pay attention to the experiences of our everyday lives and the arising and passing away of phenomena that we see when we meditate, will just naturally open our hearts to a place of loving kindness and compassion, and sending that out to a world that is so badly in need of it. Let's send out the wish that all beings, just like us, want to be happy. May all beings be free.